From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in sculpted Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games. In this episode, we talk with Freya Holmer, developer of the modeling tool Half Edge, to discuss 3D for indie devs. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start. Okay, before we start, Freya, we're going to put you on hold for just a second. Lydia, you have some timely news you want to tell our listeners?
Yes, I'm going to be at the Serious Play 2025 conference in Rochester, New York, this coming August. So August 13th to 15th is the main conference. I'll be there. There's apparently an esports summit on August 16th. We'll see if my past lets me in on that, or at least I'm going to find out some more info. Mm-hmm. If you have any questions or things that you want to hear about from that conference, check it out yourself, but also ping me in the Discord. Mm-hmm.
And Ellen has been to this conference previously mm-hmm. and talked about it on the show.
Yes.
So you can go back and find that episode if you're curious as to what that's all about. Mm-hmm. But you got a press pass this year.
I did.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So we're going to.
Thank you so much.
We'll hear back more later on in the calendar.
And now.
All right. To the show. Freya, welcome back to the Clubhouse. This is your third appearance on the program. Stretched out over many years. We feel like we're like you're like a regular and a pal, but like we don't see that much. But it's great to see you again. How you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing pretty well. I'm a little bit distracted right now because I got into cat photography for the past like 2 months, and
right.
So I've been
show
like,
canceled.
All of my Let's projects have been
that.
Delayed.
Cats. Quick, Paul Dale.
Okay.
But I'm doing really well. It was like a really good excuse to like go out the door and actually get some exercise and walk more in general.
That's good.
So it was like a very good like way to touch grass, I think.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I like that. Yeah. Excuses and frameworks. That's what we all need. And I guess speaking of excuses, mm-hmm. one of the reasons that we wanted to have you back on the show is just generally we're looking for excuses to have you back on the show.
Yes.
But specifically, you're developing this tool Half Edge, which sounds like so up my street that I'm just excited about it. And so normally on this program, we don't like to have people come on and like hawk their wares, but like, whatever. Like,
yeah, listeners, Mark has been talking about this thing for 3 months or something now.
But I think it's very, I mean, listeners, you don't have to feel too duped as a change to our format because I think, and I want to hear this from you, it solves a particular set of problems that indie developers have. And so I guess before we get into sort of our outline, just give us a background on what the, sort of the problem space and like why you thought to do something about it.
Well, it's for a bunch of reasons. Like with most of my tools, it's generally coming from a place of I want the tool myself. Mm-hmm. Like I'm facing issues in my workflow and I want to do something about it. And, you know, if that grows into a bigger and bigger tool, then of course there's a possibility to like, okay, maybe other people want this and then I could sell it. And then that's going to be, you know, part of my income going forward. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, right now, I think 60% of my income is from selling Unity plugins. And then like 30% is from my Patreon supporters. And then the rest is YouTube. Mm-hmm. That is what sustains all of my projects right now. Most of my projects are just like money drains. But this one, like making tools, I don't know, like when talking to like indie devs, the way that I usually frame it is like, you know, when you're working on an indie game, you sort of have to convince everybody to like your game.
Yes.
But when you're a tool developer, people just kind of like your stuff before you've even like finished anything. And you generally don't have to convince them that it's something they want. And so like, I think personally, I just got into tool dev because I got so much like dopamine from people like wanting the thing that I'm making.
Yeah.
And so which is also really nice because I'm not good at advertising, so I'm glad that people want it. So.
Can I ask what the first initiation point between this is a frustrating thing to I am going to do something about it and kind of just believing that you can fix it on your own? What was the ignition for that?
Usually I start experimenting. Like I start making it. And then I can just like get a better sense of like, what is the scope of this? How viable is it? Is it possible at all? You know, how much work is it going to be? So usually I just start experimenting and start prototyping the tool. And, you know, I have a lot of tools that are just never released because some of those prototyping stages just go nowhere, right? Mm. But with, let's see, how many plugins have I made? I made Shaderforge back in the day. Jesus Christ, I'm old now. So Shaderforge... it was like 10 years ago, like damn.
Yeah.
So it was Shaderforge, and then Shapes was the more recent plugin, and then now working on Half Edge. But yeah, and so like all of these came from you know, needing the tool myself, wanting it myself. And then I start prototyping. And then as soon as I can see like kind of the path from start to finish, I'm like, okay, well, this could probably be something that I can scale to something that's, you know, applicable to other people. But of course, there's a big step there. There's a big jump between making a tool for yourself, because like in-house tools are jank and generally just like you just want to get the thing working, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But if you want to make something that you sell to other people, you need to consider UX like way more than, you know, for in-house tools.
Yeah.
And so it would definitely, like, it does kind of look more similar to game development in that sense that you need to take into account so many more aspects of, you know, creating a project like that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I enjoy almost all of those aspects of making something like this.
And I think I definitely want to talk about that process, especially because you've spoken earlier about how it started out as a Unity plugin and moved into its a standalone product. I want to hear about that transition. Mm-hmm. But I think first I want to ask about like the state of these kinds of workflows. So indie devs, if you want to do 3D, Blender. It's Blender, mm-hmm. right? If you have some experience, mm-hmm. it's Maya or 3D Max, if you can and you have a lot of money. Speaking for myself, like, I've used Blender enough to be dangerous, but I always forget everything about it because I'm doing so many other things and I bounce back to it in a way that mm-hmm. maybe other people have this experience with other types of tools like Photoshop or, you know, video editing tools. Because I have background in those areas, I find that a little bit more seamless. Mm-hmm. And so I get very frustrated when I don't have that proficiency with Blender. I almost sort of expect to have it. I learn it and I'm like, oh, I totally know how this works. And then 2 months later, I come back to it and then completely nothing.
Like, you don't even have a muscle memory.
Yeah.
Like a hint of it. Yeah.
And so that's my particular problem. But I think from what I've heard about your sort of philosophy for Half Edge is that it's meant for game developers, not necessarily for 3D artists first. And so tell me about like the state of the industry is like Maya and Blender and your background with those tools that sort of made you decide you need something else.
Yeah, I think before I got into shader programming and programming in general, actually, I was doing environment art and 3D modeling. I was using Maya for the most part.
Yeah.
And, you know, while I was at my studio, I had a license through the studio. But then as soon as I left and I was freelance, I was like, okay, I don't have Maya anymore. How do I get Maya? And then I, you know, Autodesk.com, go to the buy page, and I'm like, Jesus Christ,
yeah.
Like, this is ridiculously expensive. Like, this is just unreasonable. Like, any one person can't just get, like, a commercial license for these things unless that's, like, a huge investment, right? And personally, I just hate subscription services in general. Like, if I don't like the fact that my, like, creative outlet has this recurring cost, like that just feels fundamentally really mean and like not great, you know. Like what if I just don't have a lot of money and I can't afford Maya anymore, and then I can't do my craft anymore? Like, that sucks, right? Like, why is it like that? Like, obviously it is like that because they want to make more money, obviously. But and so, you know, I was missing Maya, and then I started using Blender because that's obviously the go-to. Like, okay, that's the open source, the free version of 3D modeling tools. And so I started using Blender and I didn't like it much at all.
Yeah.
I think it was just like, it's very convoluted and it doesn't really follow the industry standards that, you know, many 3D editors use.
Sure.
And so kind of makes me very lost. It's like super hotkey based. Mm-hmm. If any programmers are listening, I would say that Blender is like the Vim of 3D modeling tools.
Wow.
Where like everything is a hotkey and it's super obtuse and like the UX is like all over the place. And I think that the thing that really like tipped me over the edge was I was using the UV editor for like, I was exposed to it for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And after that point, I was like radicalized and I was like, fuck this. Like, I can't do this anymore. Like I'm someone who loves UV mapping. I loved UV mapping in Maya. It was so fun. I enjoyed it. Like, there's like one plugin that you needed to have some alignment tools, but coming to Blender, it was just a miserable experience. It's improved a lot since I started using it, I'm pretty sure. But in general, it's just a pretty overwhelming experience, even for someone like me who has done 3D modeling before. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't done any 3D modeling, I can imagine it's even more overwhelming to open Blender.
Yeah, I've tried to open up Blender several times, and every time I do it, I'm like, ugh, because it's so it's scary.
And it's huge, mm-hmm. right? Like yeah. it's, you know, that is also by design. Like Blender is a huge piece of software yeah. and it's supposed to do a lot of different things.
Right, right.
But usually when I use Blender, I'm only using like, I don't know, 5% of Blender. That's what I need to do my like, I don't know, polygonal modeling, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then Blender can do like video editing, like cinematic stuff and like all of that stuff that's Jeez. Tacked on top of it.
Wow.
And that adds so much complexity. Mm-hmm. And it also, you know, that affects your UX. That affects the types of hotkeys that you can use. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many downstream effects of complexity that make something intimidating. Yeah. Like it's kind of like, you know, when you open Blender, it's like you're put in the seat of like a Boeing 747, right? You're just yeah. like, Jesus Christ, what are all of these buttons? Uh-huh. Like,
yeah.
You just pray that you won't crash, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think an underappreciated feature of huge creative packages, and I think a good example of this is that I've experienced with is After Effects, which is video compositing. It is incredibly overwhelming. It has so many features, but when you start, you can start poking around with the most basic features yeah. very quickly. And you will be very ignorant of what's going on, and you will kind of do things wrong, but you can still use it. Mm-hmm. And I think Photoshop is sort of similar. Like, people always, for decades, have complained about like how complicated and unintuitive Photoshop is. But like one of the reasons, aside from the business model,
yeah.
that has maintained its popularity is because it is actually approachable. Blender, for all of its especially recent advancements, I totally agree. It's very hard to do the first thing you need to do
yeah.
in Blender. Mm. Even if you do have some experience with it, you kind of have to like settle in and like boot up your own sort of interface in your mind with it. That is a huge problem. And yeah. it's not to, I mean, I don't, Freya, you may have a different opinion on like the Blender group's approach or why they haven't been able to make that as approachable, but it's just a really hard problem, right?
Yeah, it's a really difficult problem. I don't, as much as I didn't like Blender, I wouldn't like blame them too much because it's fundamentally a huge piece of software. And when you've been around for as long as Blender has been around, even just making changes comes with so much friction because people right. are used to their yeah. workflows and plugins. And so, you know, you have a ton of baggage just from that. And so it's hard to make changes. And I think one of the biggest struggles that open source projects have in general is UX. There's so many like open source projects that are, you know, who makes open source projects, right? Like what kind of person does that? It's generally programmers, mm-hmm. right? And if you ask a programmer how you do 3D modeling, they're probably not going to have as much experience as, you know, an actual artist.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, a 3D artist doesn't know how to code, you know, tools, right?
Right.
And so it's kind of this like, there's kind of this weird thing where like all of the open source projects are generally just started by people who have programming knowledge, but then don't really know all of the workflow aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, like bigger companies seem to be better at, you know, onboarding people who do have experience with things like design and UX and art. And so I think a lot of open source projects tend to fall into this vibe of being a bucket of features mm-hmm. where like mm-hmm. it technically has all the features, but the UX is so underdeveloped that yeah. it feels super clunky to use, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think GIMP is probably a good example where like usually my point of comparison is like if you consider the list of features that GIMP has, and then you consider the list of features that something like Procreate has. I don't know if you've used Procreate. It's a 2D art tool on the iPad. And so if you consider the list of features between these two programs, GIMP looks like the clear winner. It's got a ton of features that Procreate just doesn't have. Mm-hmm. And Procreate costs money while GIMP is free. So like on paper, it looks like GIMP is just the clear winner, right? But if you ask any artist which one they prefer, they all love Procreate. Like Procreate yeah. feels amazing to use. It feels so good. I think it's that's I'm sort of faced with the same type of challenge, I think, for Half-Edge. So I sort of see Half-Edge as being the Procreate of modeling tools,
okay.
where I want it to be approachable, have less features than Blender. It's going to be of a smaller scale, and it's going to have a more narrow audience of, you know, mostly indie developers. I usually call it like a mid-poly modeling tool, which is, I don't know, I just find it funny calling it mid. But and yes, I'm sort of trying to find that same niche of I do programming, but I'm also an artist. Like, I know how you work with art, how you do 3D modeling. I can do design. I do tool design and UX. Like, I have so much experience in all of those things. So for me, I can make something like this and also kind of be aware of what you generally want as an artist out of these tools.
Right, right. And I think you speak to a lot of why you're the person to make it. Like having that background and having those problems to solve. And I think it's interesting because there's the comparison between a tool like you're building or a tool like Procreate versus its open source equivalent. And then there's the other side, which is comparing GIMP to Photoshop, where you'd see them as roughly, I think GIMP has all the features that Photoshop has, but it's much harder to use. And in the 3D modeling space, 3ds Max or Maya, and you have experience with those tools. So apart from price and access, which I think is a good enough reason, right?
Yeah.
And that's why Procreate is so, one, successful and beloved, because it is affordable and it does what you need,
right,
compared to something like Photoshop, which shackles you to a subscription, even if you could find yourself declaring it worth it.
Mm-hmm.
People love Procreate for that reason. I guess what I'm looking for is like your thoughts on those professional packages. If in a world everyone could afford Maya, would that be good enough, or does your tool solve a different problem than that?
Personally, it would probably be good enough for me to the point where I wouldn't make Half Edge anymore, because I wouldn't be as frustrated to like do spite-driven development. But if the question is more like, is there a space for Half Edge even though Maya would be free? I do think so, yes, because there's just a lot of stuff when it comes to designing the UX for what tools you put like really close to the user and what tools you put further away from the user that, you know, Maya just doesn't prioritize. It's hard to come up with like many examples, but there's like so many small things that add up. So for example, let's say that you are, I don't know, do you any of you do level design, like 3D games?
I have done some for 3D games before, yeah.
Okay, have you used any, like, have you used like Hammer or Source 2?
No, I was working straight in the Unity editor.
Okay. That's such a good comparison though. So I wish one of you had used Hammer. So some of the older level design tools, and also Source 2 specifically, they have you create geometry in the editor itself. Usually this would be called like BSP editing or CSG, where like, you know, if you're in Unity, you don't create geometry in Unity generally.
Yeah.
If you're using ProBuilder, maybe, if you're like masochistic. But otherwise, generally, you don't create geometry in editor. But but you used to in many games, like Unreal Tournament, like some of the early ones, the Source games, any like earlier Half-Life or Quake games, like making geometry in editor was something that was prioritized.
Yeah.
And when you make geometry, so usually you would make, you know, a room. You would create the walls, you would create a ceiling, you would create the floor.
Yeah.
You would maybe create a table out of this geometry as well. So like anything that's relatively simple in terms of, you know, poly count, you would create in editor. And if you consider like what tools you want for this type of workflow, one very, very, very simple feature that Hammer has that most other 3D editors don't have is that you can change the grid size with a hotkey. So if your grid size is just like, you know, 1 meter, and then you press a button and then it halves it to half a meter, then you press a button and it halves it again to 0.25 meters, and then you have another button for increasing the grid size. That one feature of having the grid size on your hotkeys, and then anytime you create geometry, it snaps to that grid, it means that you can go from, you know, you're creating a room and then you're like filling in all the grid points, and then you want to create a doorway. So maybe you decrease the grid size. Maybe you want to create a trim along the wall. You decrease the grid size again and then create the block on that grid. Mm-hmm. Maybe you then want to create a pillar in the room. So you increase it again and then you create a block, and then maybe you want to align it. So you know, decrease the grid size and then snap it. Mm-hmm. And like that entire workflow is completely disrupted if you don't have hotkeys for that type of workflow.
Yeah, sure.
Because then it's like, we can go back to the bucket of features comparison of like, you can ask someone, you know, oh, you can't do this in Blender. But then you're like, oh, but you can change grid size in Blender. It is actually possible to change the grid in Blender. You just go, you know, to your scene, edit, and then, or like view, edit, grid size, and then it opens a window, and then scroll down, and then you can type in the, you know, grid size on the x-axis, y-axis, and z-axis, and then, you know, press up, apply, and then you've changed the grid size.
It's just that easy.
And it's like, okay. But yeah, like, technically it's possible to change the grid size, but you don't have hotkeys that you can just mash to like change the grid size, right?
Yeah.
And that changes the way that you work with the tool. Yeah, it just does.
Yeah. Like, for one, how would you know? For two, why would you bother?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it'll just the idea of like, presumably, perhaps even in Blender, you could find a way to like put together a macro or come up with it, made a, that situation going, which is like, but I think the what you're speaking to really is the like, what does the tool prioritize? Like, and I think that, and the I think particularly when it comes to game development, it's very the work you're making, the 3D work you're making, is not just visual. It also has utility. And so I think a lot about like graphic design is very similar. It's meant to look good, but also has function.
Right.
And so, you know, grids is very important. Even if you're not going to make a sort of voxel looking thing, you still want that because other things work on that grid or function that way. And so I could definitely see that as being something where I'm in the Blender project and I'm adding features and I'm not thinking that's a big deal, you know, because I'm not thinking of the audience, even though that's a big part of my audience.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like anytime you want to make anything modular, like a modular kit of models that you want to snap together and work together, and all of that stuff is just going to be like 10 times easier if you're sticking to a grid. And it doesn't mean like everything have to be snapped to the grid. It's just like having some common language for, you know, how thick walls should be and how thick, you know, handrails should be. Yeah. And if you just have a regular grid size that you tend to use for those things, all of that stuff's going to be so much easier.
Yeah.
You had brought up a few times that this tool specifically built for indie devs. And other than the price, because, you know, that is quite prohibitive for indie devs. What important distinctions are there between like the 3D workflows for AAA games versus indie?
So I'm not fully, I don't know too much about the AAA pipeline.
Okay.
So I'm not like fully, like I haven't worked at like AAA studios doing 3D modeling. I only did that in an indie capacity.
Okay, that's fair.
But so for example, if you're doing AAA stuff, you are generally going to be doing a lot of very high poly stuff.
Yeah.
You're going to do a lot of like retopologizing. You're going to be doing like ZBrush sculpting. Mm-hmm. You're going to be baking a high poly into a low poly to get a normal map. You're going to be like going back and forth between, you know, maybe Substance Painter and your modeling tool. And like, there's a lot of extra tooling there that's required just for the high poly workflow.
Sure.
And then in addition to that, there's also like, you know, NURBS, sub-D modeling. If you want to do anything like hard surface. And so that's, it's sort of partially because I want to make sure that I also limit the scope of this because, you know, I'm one person and I don't want to make it, you know, a tool for literally everyone, right? And so that's sort of why I'm intentionally not targeting AAA development. You know, if AAA studios want to use it, that's fine, but I'm not going to design it for that, right? And so that's one way I'm limiting the scope for that. But otherwise, I mean, there's obviously a lot of overlap between AAA and indie in terms of the kinds of tools that you would want in a 3D editor. So it's more so just like limiting it to that mid poly, you know, sector or mid or low poly, right?
Got it.
Because, you know, I don't know, fundamentally, I feel like games are kind of unnecessarily high poly. Like, we don't need that much in AAA games. I feel like it's not that much about fidelity anymore. Maybe it used to be, but I feel like it's so much more about, you know, the atmosphere that you can get in a game, the vibe of the game, and like all of those things that don't really have anything to do with fidelity. I feel like AAA is like unusually obsessed with fidelity compared to indie developers.
Yeah, it's kind of the same way that like movies like have that cinematic look because like they want it to feel more prestige and important. I think at least it's an aspect of it. And yeah, I totally see what you're saying. My limited understanding of AAA 3D modeling workflows is like a lot of people just work on their specific things, so they have their tool that they work in almost exclusively.
Things are siloed.
Yeah, things are siloed,
which is kind of why you can have these things with very disparate workflows, because there's just somebody to handle that and somebody else to handle the handshake. And then I guess that maybe just speaks to team size. Not necessarily the types of games.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah, you might be an indie dev of 20, which is, I guess, relatively small compared to like AAA sizes, but big for indie. And
but
you might
have a couple of Blender or Maya artists, and they don't ever touch the engine.
Yeah,
and that works for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not, you can't expect that to scale down.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's useful to have something available for people who are working in less lower fidelity models, and but want something that's more accessible to them to use. Mm-hmm. That's not Blender, I guess, because it's too big. It's got too much stuff in it. So that's useful.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the next sort of batch of questions is, like, what do these workflows look like for people who are wearing multiple hats?
Yeah.
Or teams of four, where there is someone who's dedicated to, you know, like environmental modeling or just all the modeling in a game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are the sort of barriers, and when could, say, a tool that is designed for indies be something that would actually be difficult for someone who's a dedicated modeler?
Are you thinking like what would make, or like what would make something like Half Edge not useful to that person?
Yeah, I guess, I guess that's the sort of counterexample is like, is there, like you say, like AAA studios can use it, but you're not really thinking about them. But if you think about like, are you focused on the developer who is dipping their toes in, or are you also thinking about someone who is on the team of five, the 3D modeler?
Oh, I mean, totally the team of five. Like the so I want it to be approachable to beginners, but it's not like a huge priority. Like I want it to be like I think fundamentally my goal is that it should be nice to use for people who are in that five person team. Like it just should be nice. It should feel like it fits nicely, like, you know, like a glove, right?
Yeah.
Like with Blender, I feel like I never feel like it fits at all. I feel like I'm stumbling through Lego bricks, right?
Yeah.
And like, sure, I can achieve the thing that I wanted to do. It was just a nightmare and I don't want to do it again.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, going back to comparing, you know, GIMP and Procreate is fun. I enjoy using Procreate. It makes me want to use it more because it has really, really good UX. And it's that kind of thing that I want to encourage and make sure that it feels lightweight. It's not like a dumbed down type of software where, you know, there's certain types of software where it's so approachable to the point where it becomes useless to professional developers, right? But that's not what I want to do. I want to make sure that it does have, you know, the full suite that you would need for polygonal modeling without being so, you know, simplified to the point of uselessness, right?
Yeah.
Do you think there's a space for, as you described it, like the dumbed down version? Or do you think that someone who is maybe even scared to get started, do you think what they do need is just a more approachable professional tool? Or is there a space for something that's not Half Edge, but another tool that is the sort of my first 3D modeling? Or is it just not useful to have those different categories?
There is a space for that. There's a bunch of smaller modeling tools. I'm trying to think of them. So PicoCAD is an example of a much more simpler modeling tool. There's also Trench Broom, which is a lot more level design focused.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Crocotile, which is a tile-based 3D thing. It's kind of a weird mix.
Yeah.
So these are kind of in that space of a much more approachable tool, but you might not necessarily use it for, you know, in production for game development. But even then, people still use it to create just art pieces, right?
Yeah.
And I think that in and of itself has value. Like, I don't care if you use it professionally. I think it's awesome that people make things in it regardless, even if it's quote-unquote pointless, you know? I think that's a necessary part of life, especially these days.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's cool. And there's absolutely a space there. It's just that for me personally, I want to use it myself for the projects that I work on. And so, it naturally falls into, you know, I want it to be a tool for professional developers as well.
Okay. But it sounds like you're mostly targeting developers, 3D modelers specifically. You said that team of five. I'm also imagining situations where you're a team of two or three and everybody's got to wear all the hats. And so somebody has to also do the 3D modeling and the level design and code the game, and the other person's marketing it, and the other, you know, they're all doing things. I don't know what they're doing. They're doing all of it all.
Stop bothering Steven about it, everybody.
Yeah, gosh.
Yeah.
So in that situation, it kind of sounds like this tool could potentially work for them, at least in that if this process is smooth for them and they understand how it works, that they could use that. But it doesn't necessarily sound like it's a great fit for people who are starting out this three-person team, and they've been forced to work in 3D modeling and they don't know what they're doing yet.
I mean, ideally it would be.
Okay,
like
okay.
It's there's always a trade-off between, I mean, that's kind of a matter of like, how do you get people into the software and how do you make sure that the complexity is not exposed all at once?
Yeah.
Maybe what you're poking at is that it's not intended to teach, but it is intended to be welcoming and a smooth transition into using it.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Does that sound a bit more?
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's always a, you need to like strike a balance between you know, like I mentioned, how many things do you want to expose from the get-go that you have in the program, right?
Yeah.
So for example, so one thing I've been considering in order to alleviate this problem, to make it a little bit easier for people who start out, when you make a 3D model, right, in a 3D editor, you can make multiple models in one project. Mm-hmm. You're not really making a model. You're making a scene that can contain models, right? That is an added layer of a complexity. Like, that's quite a lot of complexity if you're not used to, you know, a scene hierarchy, right? So that's a space where I've considered making it so that when you start Half-Edge for the first time or a new project, when you're creating something, you are only working on one model. And if you want to create a whole scene hierarchy, that's something you then have to enable for that project. So then that means that I don't need to have, you know, an outliner in the UI. That's a huge amount of space I can just remove. And I don't need to show any buttons or a hierarchy or any of those tools there. I can just hide it, right? Mm-hmm. And then immediately it's going to look so much more approachable. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in Blender, all of those things are open from the get-go, right? Like it's always like right there, and it's got like a gazillion buttons and tabs and horizontal tabs and vertical tabs and icon tabs and text tabs. And it's like, Jesus, it's like so much, right?
You're very much touching on the idea of opting into challenge, opting into difficulty, and allowing the user to be able to self-regulate their own level of complexity, which is really neat.
Yeah, exactly. But I also want to make sure that I don't do it to the degree where, like, you know, I have a video game style progression where you need to, like, unlock features. So like, then it's like, oh, you download it on someone else's computer, and then you're like, oh, goddammit, the progression system is stopping me. Like,
you don't want to have that happen. Level 5 3D modeler.
Make sure your cloud saves are synced, right?
Hey, I have some feedback.
Oh?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, are we allowed to accept feedback from within the clubhouse?
I mean, we do that anyway,
I can stand outside the clubhouse. Come on.
Oh, no.
Okay. So, my picture is not on the feedback form.
What?
It's
what?
Ellen's picture.
Oh, dear. We got to change that.
Man, I thought I caught all of those.
Yeah. We got to fix that quick.
Okay. Well, as long as we're on the subject
of
the feedback form, Stephen, what's the deal?
Well, you should go to the feedback form and give us feedback so we change and improve the program. It's useful for us to get that feedback, because otherwise we're just going to keep on keeping on, because we think very highly of ourselves, and otherwise, I guess, I don't know. But let us know why we're wrong. Let us know what we're doing wrong and what can be improved. And also let us know what we're doing right, so that we know that we're on the right track with our episodes.
Yeah, and sometimes it's nice just for our own personal psychology. I mean, I'm looking at some of these. Just wanted to say you're all fantastic.
Yeah.
The good work.
Yeah.
Keep making nice games and nice podcasts. Mm-hmm. Keep being awesome. I mean, go ahead, I suppose. But, like, we are also looking for proper feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, feel free to mix a little bit of the sugar with the spice.
There's an entire section where you can tell me, Stephen McGregor, that I am incorrect about something.
Yeah.
And we've only gotten one response.
It's important to separate out that, because we're not taking responsibility for Stephen's errors.
Yeah.
As a program.
Except, it's just me, so let me know.
Yeah, and I know you're all being very kind about it, because we've just got the one response, but we could use a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. You can go to nicegames.club/feedback and let us know.
As you're going through this process, it sounds like you are your fundamental client playtester, because this is something that you want to make. How are you balancing your own idiosyncrasies and your own desires for this tool with the general person on the street who could pick this up? Because tools end up being very, very personal, as are workflows.
Yeah.
Everybody has like their own kind of weird habits and desires for that.
Yeah, I sort of treat it the same way I do with indie game development, where it's going to definitely be colored by my own preferences. Absolutely. There's no getting around that, right? And especially because, you know, I'm the most productive when I'm making things that I want to work on that's interesting to me. And so it's just going to be, it's going to be whatever I find interesting, for better or for worse, right? Mm-hmm. It means that certain niche features are going to be very well developed compared to other programs, but it also means that some features might not even be there at all because I don't want them or need them or use them, right? So yeah, that is a tricky balance to figure out exactly where to draw the line for what to include or not include. So like a really good example of this is something I've been struggling with a lot with the Halfhenge is non-destructive workflows. I don't know exactly where or how, where to draw that line, because non-destructive stuff is a huge thing. It's a big undertaking to work on, but it's also something that people really like having. And so I'm not sure yet, like where, if I should do those things. And so that's currently something that I'm not working on. Another category is animation. So I'm not going to have animation tooling. Like for 1.0, I'm not going to have animation because animation is a whole can of worms. Like there's so much tooling. There's so much like interface design I need to do. There's so much UX. And there's also the like file management. Like, oh, if you export to FBX, I'm like, oh, okay. How does the FBX file format store animations? And how do they do interpolation of different types of, you know, vector 3 or a float parameter or a bool interpolation? Is that even possible? How do they interpolate rotations? Do they use Y-up or Z-up? Are they right-handed or left-handed? Like, the list goes on, right? Yeah. So I need to be super, super careful with scope. And so, I do actually have a list on my website, I think, for like what I'm intentionally not including for 1.0, and unfortunately there's going to be a lot of features that are there that people like. So animation is one of them, rigging, skinning is one of them. There's also a boolean operations is a, that's a can of worms as well. There's a lot of stuff like that.
There's a lot of that I would not have even thought about would be in 3D modeling tools.
Is part of the scope also trying to figure out how much you worry about your tool playing nice with other tools that will then have to handle the rigging, will have to handle the animations? You know, you can still intentionally model something that could get rigged, but having to do that in a different piece of software, you do still kind of have to take on that responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. So usually those things are done through like intermediate file format. Mm-hmm. So depending on the file format, like OBJ doesn't support this, but FBX does. Like FBX does store a bunch of extra data, so you can like transfer them between different, they're called DCCs. I forget what it's called, digital content creation. I don't know.
Yeah.
Between like 3D Max or Unity or Maya or whatever. So they're interchangeable in their file formats if you're using the right file formats. For me, it's mostly about that. If I just make sure that I follow, you know, what FBX is supposed to look like, then you would be able to import that into Blender and then do animations there and then import it back into Halfhenge.
Yeah, that notion, that interoperability, because if the scope is small, then you either are putting your opinion on the workflow. So I'm not including this feature because I'm not expecting the developer to need it or want it or use it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they need it or wanted to use it, the tool's not for them. Or the other side of that is I'm not including this feature, this thing, and if the developer needs or wants to use it, they can find another tool to do that.
Yeah.
And so the question is how much are you considering this tool's place in the broader workflow? It sounds like you're not stressing too much about covering every use case, but are you also interested in essentially not just having your quirks embedded into the tool you're building, but how much are you interested in imposing your opinion on what a workflow should look like, and people not interested in that can just go somewhere else?
That's hard to answer. It's I wouldn't really do it intentionally. It's more so like out of necessity more than anything else in terms of cutting down features, I think. I mean, there's some things that sort of has that vibe. Like for example, if you have a grid in, if you have a grid and everything is like snapped to a grid, if that grid is in powers of two, in other words, you always divide by two or multiply by two in terms of the, you know, subdivisions, that is a style of grid that level editors usually use. So the Source Engine, Trench Broom, and the old Unreal tools used to have that kind of power of two grid. So it's not, you know, you have 1 meter and then you divide it by 10 to get like decimeters, and then you divide that by 10 to get, you know, centimeters. It's not like that. It's always divided by two. You know, is that good or bad for your project? Well, if you're making games, it might not matter that much if it's pretty abstract. But if you're doing architecture, you really want to have, you know, measurements that are real world units, right? But the thing is, if you use a power of two grid, that's like the most binary friendly format ever. That's the best way to snap things. If you're going to deal with any kind of, you know, misalignment of vertices in different projects, all of those issues are going to be, you know, the least problematic if you use a power of two grid. So then you could ask the question of like, should I force everybody to use the power of two grid, or should I make it an option to use, you know, a power of 10 grid for, you know, a metric style thing, or maybe another like thing for like freedom units if you want to do feet and inches or whatever. Like I could add options for that. And so that decision for me, usually what I end up doing is like, I default to what I think people should be using, but then I let people choose if they want to use something else. Mm-hmm. And then if they choose that something else, I can just add a little warning box of like, hey, you might deal with alignment issues if this type of grid, but feel free to use it if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's kind of my approach. If it doesn't take too much work to, you know, accommodate other people's workflow. So yeah, to me, it's almost always a question of like how much work it is for me to do that thing, because, you know, any one thing I'm working on means that I'm not working on everything else. Right. And so that's kind of the way that I need to consider it.
Well, it goes back to this, just that we were talking about grids earlier in the episode, about like presenting it as the default option and availability. And it's like, well, if you can give people multiple choices, but you remain opinionated in what you present them first, what you present them as the most mm-hmm. polished, most default experience. And some of that can be deliberate, and some of it can just be, that's just what you end up making, and that's what it is. It doesn't all have to be, I guess, planned out and justified, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm realizing that, I mean, I guess I already knew this, because the tool kind of does dictate a lot of how you approach working on things, and the tool you decided to use impacts a lot of those decisions. I'm a Unity person, so oftentimes when somebody is asking me to do something in Unity, I'll look at Unity and go like, oh, we can do this pretty easily in this engine, or it's kind of difficult to do in Unity. We should maybe consider a different approach or what have you. Mm-hmm. I imagine that will be the case with this tool, and that's going to be the case with every other tool. But having a tool that's like kind of real specific, not that this is specific, but like it isn't, I guess it's not as broad as Blender. It kind of can limit what a person might consider doable using this tool. And I'm curious if... Mm-hmm. That is actually a positive, because like limits are beneficial to guiding development, or at least forcing you to get the dang thing done. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about like that in particular.
I think the having like features missing that you might want to have, I think it could sort of make the creative argument of like maybe the way that you would work would change in a positive way in one regard, but I wouldn't really make that argument. I think that's possible, but for me, it's always about the benefits you get from having a tool that's designed for game development specifically, right? So there's obviously going to be drawbacks, because Half-Edge is, you know, I'm competing with Blender. Like, Jesus Christ, that's mm-hmm. difficult, right?
Right.
Near impossible. And so I'm never going to be able to compete on features. And so for me, I just put a lot of weight into the UX.
Okay.
The experience of using it should feel nice. It should be smooth. It should feel lightweight. And so that example of like having a hotkey for changing the grid size, that's the kind of thing that changes the way that you work with the tool.
Yeah.
In a positive way. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that there are a gazillion tiny, tiny things like that mm-hmm. people don't ever think about. But just having those things is going to fundamentally change the way it feels to use the tool.
Yeah.
And the game development focus on it as well is something that it's sort of been a mystery to me as for why UV editors are all terrible. I haven't figured out why that's the case. And I'm like, because so many of the things that I feel are missing in every UV editor I've ever used are simple features to add, like stupidly simple. Like as a tool developer, I know how to implement things, right? But they're just not implemented. And so in my mind, I'm like, okay, do the developers of, you know, Maya or Blender, do they just not do UVs? Do they just hate UVs and nobody does UV mapping? And so it kind of got me thinking, like, I wonder if it might be the case that like the UV tools were designed for cinema and game developers do UV mapping in a very precise and particular way, because game developers care about texture resolution, and you want to like make sure that things are perfectly aligned.
Yeah.
But if you do cinema, you just make sure you don't have stretching, and then you can use a super high resolution texture anyway, right?
Yeah.
I think there's, just when it comes to even just the UV tool itself, something as simple as when you move UVs, you can enable snapping to pixels. Mm-hmm. That's like a super simple feature. Yeah. It's ridiculously easy to add. But like, does Blender or Maya have that? I don't think they do. Maybe if you like go to the grid settings and type in the texture resolution, but it doesn't do that automatically, right? But what if it did do that automatically? So like whatever texture you're using on that object, that's going to be your grid when you're editing the UV. Super simple thing that like that's just not a thing in the other editors. Another example, which has less to do with the game development versus not game development thing, but more to do with the fact that Half-Edge is modern, is that if you consider, you know, when were all of these modeling tools created? How old is 3D Max? How old is Maya? And how old is Blender? Like, they're all 10 plus years. Is Maya and Max, are they like 20 years old at this point? Oh, I forget. I don't even know. Well, it's not like all ancient.
If we think about that too much, we'll realize how old we are.
Exactly. And we don't like to think about that.
Right,
but they're
right,
old.
Right.
So for example, one feature, so that gives me some advantages because I can work with some like more modern workflows that people might come to expect from a modern piece of software.
Yeah.
A good example of that is having tabs, opening two models at once. Like,
right.
3D, like, artists, like, probably don't even ever think about that because they're so used to not having that feature, right? But what if you could open, you know, two things at once? Meanwhile, programmers are doing this every single day in the IDE. Mm-hmm. You know, you would have, like, 20 tabs open for all of your different scripts and you would jump between them.
Yeah.
You would, like, copy from one script and paste into another. The flexibility that that gives you, it's just not present in 3D editors today.
Mm-hmm.
But what if you could? And so you know, in Half-Edge, I do have tabs, so you can open multiple scenes at once. You don't have to decide if you want to save or discard your changes before you open another project. But in Maya, you have to do that. You have to make that decision, which is really annoying in terms of workflow.
Right.
And so it's all of these like roadblocks that just add up over time that they're just frustrating. And so those are the kinds of things I just want to smooth out. And I want to treat, you know, opening a 3D model or editing a 3D model, I want that to feel as simple as opening, you know, a text document in an IDE for doing scripting. Mm-hmm. It should be that easy to just open and close or edit, copy, paste. Like, it should feel lightweight. All of these other tools is this like whole, like, you're starting Blender and it's going to take some while. It'll take a while before it starts. If you want to open another scene, you have to like open another instance of Blender. So you're like loading up this whole thing again. And it's like, it's also slow.
Yeah, that's actually really fascinating. Because, I mean, Lydia, you were just talking about how like you opened up Unity to do a lot of the putting things around in places.
Yeah.
And like, it makes sense because like that's where the game is, I guess. But if you didn't have to open up this cumbersome program in order to do that, I would imagine it would make that workflow significantly
easier.
Yeah.
I felt a lot of understanding with the grid system because having to do level design in Unity is the reason why my mouse sensitivity is now always high. Because, oh my gosh, having to crawl my way across the landscape for that game took forever. And I had to just jack up the sensitivity to get anywhere, even with the scale pulled far out in Unity and then just zooming in constantly.
Yeah.
But that's another thing of like that I'm also frustrated by. Another one of those barriers of if I'm switching between Unity and Blender and then maybe some other, like maybe Rhino or something, if I'm doing CAD model or whatever, switching between all of these, they all use different camera controls.
Oh,
yeah.
I hate that. Ooh. That is so annoying. Yeah. Like, you have to relearn this every single time and it's so annoying. And so that's another thing where when I'm making Half-Edge, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to use Unity's camera controls exactly the same way it works in Unity. And then maybe I can add features if you wanted to work like Unreal's camera. So if you're using Unreal, you can switch the way that the camera works in Half-Edge so that it feels familiar to you.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's that familiarity that reduces friction. It's that kind of stuff that I want to make sure that I have.
Yeah. And I know when I open up Blender for the first time in a couple of months and like need to relearn the whole thing again.
Yeah.
Camera control is definitely one of those things. And then I'll be like, where was the settings for that? And then like, that's a whole day. but also it's like, because the camera controls are, there's multiple things there's, it's not just camera controls.
Yeah.
There's many things that comprise all the camera controls and you have to change all of those settings and I don't even know what they're called. And so I just like, all right, I'll just learn it this way again. So I'll forget it one more time. So I could definitely see that being something where, if you have a toggle, just like Unreal Unity, like what people are familiar with. Because I think that really speaks to what you were sort of describing about like with tabs and about how this is, when people load up Blender, and I think the people who make Blender sort of expect this, is you're now in a Blender session.
Yeah.
Right? And I think for game developers, even when you have different people who have specific jobs on a role, not mostly when people wear multiple hats, but not always, like these tools are in service of another tool or another workflow.
Right, right.
And I think like you're describing these things you're adding that are modern, but to game developers just seems not just modern but obvious, right? Mm-hmm. And I like that a lot because it lets you treat it sort of where it really belongs in your workflow.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that'll be really interesting to see that when Half-Edge is out. And you might find people who are dedicated 3D modelers who do open up their application for a day-long session.
Yeah.
Like, will they find things in there that works for them, or will they not? Right. I'm sure you're just as curious to find that out. I find that really fascinating because, yeah, you said it's going to be sort of Unity guided because that's your experience. But yeah, I'm just trying to like find the words for it because it is in a sense revolutionary, like an approach.
If it works well, actually are using it, yeah, we'll see.
Well, I mean,
I was trying to help you market.
Well, I'm happy to hype up.
Oh shit! I'm sorry. I mean, it's actually absolutely revolutionary. Yeah.
But I do generally mean like independent of actual like. All right, let's just imagine a world where you ship it and it's garbage, right? Like, even in that world, I think that this approach to it, I think, is revolutionary, and that is a lot of what appeals. That's why I'm so excited about it. Other than you know the experience I've had with the other tools you've made, which gives me a lot of faith in your work, just the idea is so exciting to me. Done with the praise section. So I do want to ask about game engines and that sort of overall broad like funneling into the final product.
Mm.
We talked a little about sort of interoperability and you know that's sort of a table stakes for a thing like this, file formats and everything like that. But you're also talking about like scene hierarchies and like that maybe is an option, but also maybe that's something that the game engine can handle. And how do you think about the tool's relationship to specifically Unity, because that's where your experience most lies, but just also generally where the output of Half-Edge, what is the life cycle of those things and how do you expect other tools to fit in?
So I think initially I'm mostly going to stick to Half-Edge exporting, you know, FBX files.
Yeah.
And kind of leaving it at that and not adding any kind of like specialized interoperability, at least not for 1.0. So I'm kind of, so like I could do a bunch of extra stuff where, you know, maybe I could do a thing where, you know, Unity has a hot reloading feature for your 3D model. So if you, you know, you're working on a model in Half-Edge, you're going to see the updates in Unity in real time. Like it's technically possible to make something like that. But I think right now, I think my time is better spent on other features. So yeah, like that kind of stuff, I'm not entirely sure yet, but I'm trying to keep it very narrowly focused on, you know, having one job to begin with.
Yeah.
And trying to do that really, really well as far as I can.
And then I guess then the sort of corollary to that is what is, and you talked a little bit about like features you're decidedly not including, but what about specific tasks or workflows that you're like, this is not the tool for that? Either because there are better tools or because of your managing scope.
It's not a tool for sculpting.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a tool for, at least initially, it's not going to be for rigging, skinning, or animation.
Right.
That's something I'm considering for like, you know, an update in the future in case, you know, the tool sells well and I can actually make a living off of it. Then I could look into those things. So it's not going to be for animation, not for sculpting. We'll see if I'm going to have any kind of like sub-D modeling. And it's not really made for stuff like if you do photogrammetry where you work with like super, super high poly stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not made for that either.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think those are kind of the primary big limitations right now. Oh, and it's also not like a thing where you can set up a pretty render. It's meant to be exported to engines. It's not meant to look nice in the editor itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, but obviously I'm going to have, you know, you're going to be able to see textures and all of that kind of stuff. But it's not made for like pretty rendering.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I do find that because Blender is also used as a 3D animation tool.
Yeah.
And they've been trying to push it for film. I do always find it funny, like every now and then, like, oh, right, this, I can actually get a good JPEG out of this. Like, it's, mm-hmm. I always forget mm-hmm. that that's a feature because it's just never something I think of or consider. So, like, definitely for the audience you're thinking of, like, that's, I think that will be no big loss, right? Because that's not the point.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I do kind of want to add, like, okay, I'm putting on my marketing hat now. but, like, one thing that I kind of want to add, just because it might help with marketing, is like just a turntable GIF export.
Oh,
like,
that would be nice.
It like, animates a turntable of your model and then exports a GIF, and then you can like share that or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That would be really nice.
Stuff, Like, yeah, I mean, I like that kind of stuff because, for example, Procreate has a time-lapse feature. Any drawing you do in Procreate automatically saves a time-lapse.
Yeah.
Oh.
And that's awesome. Like, I love that. As an artist, like, being able to share the time-lapse is, like, you know, it's fascinating to see someone's, you know, process of creating something.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, like, that kind of stuff I do like. But it's, that's also very much a marketing thing. But
I could also see, I generally could see how that would be very helpful for indie devs in a couple ways. One of them being just you could, you don't have to work as hard to get your portfolio pieces
yeah.
lined up and ready mm-hmm. to share.
Yeah.
And then second of all, that's kind of nice to be able to make that turntable GIF, send it over on Slack and say, hey, does this look good? Can I like make a merge request into Unity?
Yeah.
And then mm-hmm. the team can look at the GIF, go, hey, that thing's wrong. There's a weird corner there. You can change it right away without having to render it out and then do the thing, blah, 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 blah. Get a quick check.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that actually would be really, genuinely be pretty useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the Instagram friendliness of it all, and that shouldn't be discounted or dismissed cynically because that really does matter. But yeah, there seems like it'd be real workflow benefits.
I think one of the biggest challenges for me is it's hard for me specifically to convince people why they should use Halfedge. Because most people want to know that, right? Like, obviously, if you're going to pay money for something, then you need a reason to spend that money.
Right.
And it's, you know, you generally don't really trust the developer of any application to accurately represent what is good about their software. And so it's going to be hard for me to do that. And so I think kind of like the strongest, like, vector for marketing for me, it's going to be two things. One of them is going to be show, don't tell. I think just showing my features is going to be the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the other one is just going to be peer-to-peer. Like when you hear about it from a colleague, that's a really, really important part. Or hear about it on social media and someone you respect says that it's good. It's that kind of marketing that I think that's kind of the only marketing I can rely on. Because so much of the selling point of Halfedge in my mind is kind of these like invisible features of like, it feels nice to use, doesn't sell a product, right?
Yeah.
But if you have a feature that you can talk about, that's much easier to sell,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so you just can't sell UX. It's so hard to do that. So that's a huge challenge for me, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, especially with something where the UX ends up being so personal. In how you want to set up your instance of like Unity or whatever. Like everybody organizes their tabs differently. Everyone sizes their windows differently. They have their own hotkeys. They've already gone through the settings to make it work the way they want it to work. And so then the promise of it's good can ring very hollow because it can't possibly be. You've put so much work into the tools you're already using. But the promise of it can do everything is very easy to market because that's a simple yes, no. Like you can look through the list of features and check it off and say, yeah, that's a lot. All right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you just need that feature.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I'm smitten by just the sort of descriptions that you have on your website about what it is. I'm like, those are all the pain points I have. This makes a lot of sense. And so that sells me. But I could see a big part of your audience is going to be people who don't really know what they want. And they don't know why Blender isn't the solution.
That's me.
So I mean, that's just you've laid out the challenge exactly right. And I mean, here's hoping, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully, yeah. So, like, speaking of like having it sort of adapt to your current project or your current engine.
Yeah.
One of the things I really wanted to add. This is. Fundamentally, it's coming from a mathematical curiosity perspective. So this is definitely a feature that started out as like, I want to do this feature because I'm curious.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has a use case, which is good, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I want to do for Halfedge is that I want you to be able to configure which axis is pointing up and if it's right-handed or left-handed.
Yes.
Oh.
So you can basically make it match whatever engine you're using.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, 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 yes.
And that's like... I don't think any other 3D editor does allow you to do that. I know Maya lets you set if it's Z up or Y up, but it doesn't let you change handedness. So you can't change if it's, you know, left-handed or right-handed because they're kind of like polar opposites.
Yeah.
So one axis is going to be mirrored. And then you always have these like export problems where, you know, your character is lying down on the side. Okay, let's see. What was it again? And and then you have to go through all the export settings and all of that garbage. And so one thing I really want to do is that, one, I want to have a per-project configuration. So if you are working in a team, I want you all to be able to share the same configuration file. So And then that configuration file can contain all the stuff that you want to have when it comes to, you know, upexes, left-handed or right-handed. Maybe it's got some naming conventions for like the default names when you export the model. So like the default export settings, you can like put all of that in one place for the project. And then if you create a new model inside of the project itself, it knows what features to use and, you know, how to set up the scene. So you don't have to like reconfigure it every single time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, setting the upexes and the handedness is, again, one of those things that's just, you know, that's just going to simplify a lot of things. Well, not for me. It's going to make things a lot more complicated for me, but it's going to make things easier for anyone using it, right? Yeah. And you know, the way that I present that to the user is probably not going to be, oh, are you using a right-hand or left-handed coordinate system? Because who knows? Like, most people have no clue if Unity or Unreal is left-handed or right-handed, right? And so it's probably going to be something along the lines of, like, are you using Unreal? Yes or no? And then it's going to configure, like have a preset configuration that's going to match whatever engine you're picking. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be the way that I kind of present it to anyone creating a new project.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's always a lot of like, oh, I got to Google how to fix it. And then,
yeah.
And it's like always like, it's like three buttons you got to press or something.
Yeah, but you got to find those
or
buttons.
Or like invert one axis in the game engine or something. But yeah, it's not actually difficult.
Yeah.
It's just... And every time it's a waste of time.
Yeah, for sure.
It's another barrier. It's another, like, one of those unnecessary barriers. You don't want to have to think about it. You just want to make the model, right?
Yeah. To sort of kind of give a sort of a closing thesis on this for folks interested in, like, actually making their own tooling,
mm-hmm.
is, like, basically you've sort of been, from the beginning, this idea of, like, features is one thing, but in the end, the value of a tool is the experience of using it.
Yeah.
Right? Where you prioritize can really impact how people like react to it and, mm-hmm. and how long they keep it in the workflow and who uses it. And independent of whether you are a 3D modeler or whether you are, or maybe you're happy with Blender. Like, I still think it's valuable to know that, like, you know, that's what they prioritized and like maybe the frustration you've had. And maybe you say, well, you know what? It's worth it because of the open source is valuable to you or because you appreciate them just dumping constantly new features.
Yeah.
And then only occasionally fixing how things look a little bit to sort of give them a little bit of a burn.
Uh-huh.
But you know, even if you're like, that's for me, mm-hmm. I think it's important to know why.
Yeah.
Right. And like what you've gotten past for that to be for you.
Yeah.
And then if you're like, you know what, maybe I want to try something else. Well, you know, Half-Hitch is coming.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this episode is a whole advertisement for Half-Edge.
Yes.
I make no apologies. But tell us a little bit about the development plans, where it's at, if you have an expectation for release, and all the sort of basic details that I think people are now like, I'm interested. What should they know?
Oh, God, I should have something prepared for this. I don't have anything prepared, but it depends on how much time I'm going to spend on cat photography. So it depends on that. But so... I think it's a few months away from the first alpha. So I would say maybe like 3 or 4 months of work on my end in order to get it ready for the alpha.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of people on that list already. So it's going to start out with like a closed alpha and then later it's probably going to be an open beta. And yeah, so I have a bunch of like, you know, a lot of level artists and 3D artists who are all on that list. So I'm going to do a proper testing there. But yeah, it's definitely still in like very, very early stages.
Yeah.
I've shown it at a conference once and it was awfully broken, but people liked it anyway.
Oh,
I'm not sure why, but that's a very good sign.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
Broken, but they liked it anyway at a conference. Yeah.
Very much know that.
But yeah, so I think it's still some ways away, of course. But I've got a lot of stuff up and running already. Like, I got the viewport, I got polygonal modeling, I got all the selection systems, you know, saving and loading, like a bunch of that stuff is done. It's just about the spending the 90% of the time on the last like 10% of important features. And kind of like plugging all the holes. There's so many bugs that I don't notice because I have a particular workflow where like I might use a hotkey for a tool. I might not actually click on the icon itself. But then as soon as I playtested it, you know, I noticed that people click the icon, but then there's a bug where like the visuals don't update and like, oh, I don't notice that because I don't click the icons. I use the hotkeys, right?
Mm.
So there's going to be like a gazillion things like that that I just didn't think of. So yeah, it's some ways away, but it's getting there. I do have a Discord server if you're interested in following the development. So you can go to halfedge.xyz is the website. It's half-edge.xyz. So there's links to the Discord. There's an FAQ there. I think I got the FAQ there. I also have a list of features of stuff I'm going to include and not include. No. And yeah, so that's all there if you're interested. And yeah.
Good. I think that's, I mean, you've been sort of downing your ability to promote, but I think that's a pretty good sell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, yeah, I think should check that out. And yeah, we'll have to have you back to talk about, I'm so interested in like, when you have your alphas and your betas, like what your playtesting, like how that's going to be different from game development playtesting and how it's going to be exactly mm-hmm. the same. I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's going to, I'm a little bit scared, but we'll see how it goes. It's going to be like extremely, extremely useful to like yeah. have the actual use cases that people have in their projects. And you know, if, for this test in particular, I made sure to only include people who do professional work. There are some that do professional work but are new to 3D modeling as well. So it's kind of a mix of some that are new to 3D modeling but are still doing work at projects and have like actual use cases.
Yeah.
Because I do want to make sure that like, you know, if someone is completely new to it, they're probably going to ask for every feature in the world because, you know, it's important to keep the scope down, right? But someone might just ask for like, oh, I want like liquid simulation. And like, that's just not in the scope of this at all, right?
Yeah.
And so I think limiting it to people who are professionals, who are doing indie development, who are actually in production, I think it's going to help make sure that I sort of stay focused on what would make this tool nice to use.
Yeah, cool, yeah. Cool, cool. And some of that sort of like first impression feedback might be useful in a later open beta, but I suspect it would be distracting before yeah. then. Mm-hmm. And that's a scope thing too, right? Just making sure that you have the time to sort through people's feedback. I appreciate that extra dedication to your process.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important because for me, a prioritization is always going to be a huge issue. I'm always going to have to tell people that I don't have time to add that feature. Unless I become like super rich and I can hire someone to help out. But like before then, it's just going to be like most features that people think of that are like a little bit harder to make, I'm just going to have to say no because like it's a limited scope. You can talk all you want about how useful generalized Boolean intersections are. Like you can talk about that all you want, but the fact is, it's more important that you're able to move objects in the scene. That's the thing I'm working on right now, and I need to fix that. It's a bug, and that's like super, super core to the whole thing. So,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
And I have like a huge list of those like very important core things. And so, yeah, that's my constant battle. yeah. Oh, and also the thing, actually, they didn't get into that. The fact that it started out as a Unity plugin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's another one of those.
Oh,
okay. All right. I know this is the end of the episode, but we're not going to leave that out. I want to hear a little bit about that decision and maybe what was what piece of information that you learned about your own project that maybe you were either wrong about when you started or evolved as you went that led to that change.
It wasn't really about my project in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I think it was more about, I got a little sad anytime someone asked if they could use it for making models for other engines, mm-hmm. and I would have to say no. And I could sort of be like, well, I guess you could install Unity and then get it as a plugin and then make the models and then export to your other game engine, right? Whether that's Godot or Unreal or whatever. But that's not satisfying. Like that's a really annoying workflow, and nobody would do that. That's a really annoying thing to have to do.
Yeah.
And so that kind of bothered me, and I really wanted to also, like, just personally, I wanted to explore what it's like to make a standalone tool. Because I mostly made Unity plugins, and making a standalone thing has a bunch of additional things on top of it that seems like interesting challenges. File export and import, if it was a Unity plugin, there wouldn't be any export or import because it would just be a mesh object in Unity, right? Yeah. But if it's outside of Unity, then all of a sudden that's something I need to do, which is, you know, some of it is not very fun work, but some of it is kind of fun to like try to figure out just personally. And also, but I think the big thing is just that the audience is going to be so, 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 so much bigger.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, with all of Unity's, you know, I tend to draw a very stark line between Unity, the game engine, and Unity, the company. Mm-hmm. I have very different opinions about these two.
Right.
I do not like the decisions that the company is taking for a gazillion things, but the game engine is still really good. It is a good game engine. And so it's a bit of a bummer that it's not a plugin anymore, in the sense that having a good like a scene view 3D editor is a much, much, much easier sell than another standalone. Because, right. you know, if it's in the scene view, my competition is ProBuilder. That's like the easiest competition ever. Like, no problem. That I can, that's no issue at all, right? Mm-hmm. But if my competition is Maya and Blender and 3D Max, that is terrifying. Yeah. And so that is scary. And also it's just harder to like try to like show why you might want to use Halfetch when those alternatives exist. That's right. really difficult. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. And then there's people who are working on custom engines. It would be cool if they also had a tool to make models. Like yeah. like having things be engine specific is just gonna not let any of those people use it. Yeah. And so yeah. that's fun, and that's kind of fun to like be able to expand to that bigger audience. But I totally feel like I've been a big fish in a small pond, and now I'm going to be a small fish in a huge ocean because, you know, the user base is bigger. There's so much more competition. Honestly, I haven't released a standalone tool ever. I've always released it on, like, you know, the Unity Asset Store.
Yeah.
So that aspect is terrifying, but also a little bit exciting. But yeah, I have seen like a few, there's been like a couple of modeling tools that seem to try to want to hit the same niche that I wanted to, and they just completely flopped. And that's kind of scary. So I might be one of those, but I'm hoping not.
Yeah, throughout this whole episode, you've been talking about scope being an important thing. It seems like this decision exploded the scope and increased the demand so heavily. But it sounds like as you discovered what this thing was and how people use it, that was the right choice, right?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I'm disappointing every Unity user now, but but like it's, I think it's the right choice. And I, not to like be too full of myself, but I think I'm better than being stuck with Unity, you know?
Yeah.
I think the tools that I make are, I deserve better than just being stuck in the ecosystem, I think, at this point. And so I want to try to broaden.
That's our show. You can find Freya online at freyaholmer.com. For show notes and additional links on today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club, where you'll find all the other links we talked about in the episode. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, you can stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at QA workflows and designing discovery. But that's it for this week. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.